Welcome to the Logan Bartlett Show. What you're going to hear on this episode is a conversation I had with Tooey Courtemanche. Now, Tooey is the co-founder and CEO of Procore, a construction software company worth over $10 billion and doing almost $1 billion in revenue today. Tooey and I talk about a bunch of different things, including the early days of Procore, which involved bootstrapping for 12 to 13 years before ultimately getting to $10 million in annual recurring revenue and raising outside capital. We then discuss the hockey stick growth that happened after that, growing to 4,000 people today. We talk about the need to manage people out of the organization when they're not scaling as quickly as the business, as well as what he's learned from mentors like Toby Lukey from Shopify, as well as Satya Nadella from Microsoft. A really fun conversation with Tooey, one of my favorite ones to date that you'll hear now.
We were just talking before we started here that the valuation point, and it's something that people get precious about, right? And on both sides, like it's not just VCs that are trying to, I mean, it's sort of talking my own book, being like, oh, well, valuations don't matter. Pick the partner you want to work with. But the journey of who you have on the ride with you is so important from an investor standpoint. And so it's funny to hear you don't even remember the traction or the ARR multiple or any of that stuff.
No, you know, you remember the, by the way, I want to double tap on that. It is so important that you choose your, that you choose your investors right.
I assume that was from the mistake you made picking Brian Feinstein.
No, well, yeah. I'm more of an optimist. The fact that Brian and Will are both still investors in Procore and still on the board after 10 years or whatever is a testament to how much, you know, it's working out. So yeah, choose wisely. But you're right. Like, you know, I don't necessarily remember the details of like the negotiation particularly, but I just remember the, you know, those milestones, like the $1 billion valuation, which is, you know, just something as a founder, $1 billion is like, you never imagined that that was ever going to be something that you would ever be able to do. And when we came to terms with that, with a deal that was at $1 billion, I was like, it was just, it was one of those moments where, fortunately, I was with my leadership team that we were, and we kind of had it on speakerphone, but didn't really announce that it was on speakerphone. When we put it on mute and then we all started like cheering and high-fiving that we had gotten here, it's just those are the moments you remember.
Well, and the journey, if you get too caught up on the end state, you'll lose sight of the journey along the way. And I remember one of the best investments in my career, I was hung up on a $90 million valuation and they won 100. And we went back and forth. And now I share Knicks season tickets with these guys. Yeah. They came to my bachelor party and I was just wrapped around the axle. I was like, no, it's $90 million. Like that's the price I'm willing to pay. 100, I'm out. Right. And I think about that at times when you're making the decision. It's sort of like, do you want to work with these people for the next 10 years or not? And sure, the valuations matter at the margin, but especially in the last 10 years, we've seen all the oscillations of like ARR multiples and valuations and all that stuff. And So you need the through line of like what, you know, the journey is going to look like, right?
And fortunately for me, I think I was luckier than smart on this one because though I'm pretty good with being a judge of people, I always say like working with a venture capitalist is much more about the partner that you're going to work with than the brand. A funny story, one of the largest brands out there, it was like in 2009, 2010, long before we actually raised real institutional money. Steve Zahm, my co-founder, and I went up to Sand Hill Road and we walked into a firm and we pitched them. And they, of course, put us in like the far back room with the, you know, the 22-year-old analyst or whatever. That
the lights are like swinging back and forth. It looks like a prison interrogation room or whatever.
I'm like, is this a mop closet? You know, yeah. And at the end of the meeting, they're like, you know, that's really interesting. But if you could just pivot your business model to be more like Facebook. And I was thinking to myself, like, these people don't get it and they're not going to get it. But man, when I met Brian and when I met Will, they got it. And that's the other thing is I like people who are in love with the vision, right? And some other people were just in love with the business model. And that's, to me, not enough.
It's hard. So maybe describe for people, we sort of dove right in. What does Procore do?
So we are a construction software company. We're a platform. And anybody who's ever done any construction themselves, like if they built something, like remodeled a bathroom or whatever, realize that it's a highly complex and fraught with lots of challenges, mostly because It's a prototype. Your bathroom's never going to get rebuilt again. That nuclear power plant in Europe's never going to get built again. And so the complexity is just enormous. And now you have teams that are coming together. They've never worked together. So what Procore does is we provide this common layer, this common platform for data and managing these workflows that jump the different entities across these projects that just drive smooth project budgets and schedules, safety, a lot of other things. And we've now become many more things than just that because we're a platform and we have tons of partners that help extend what we do.
Yeah, I want to talk about the different products and modules and all that stuff. But originally, I guess, it was kind of project management and collaboration for building what was custom homes way back when and then became construction. And so I want to talk about that.
There's a journey there.
That pivot there. But the slippier line in the growth was unusual. So it took you 12 to 15 years or so to reach 10 million in ARR,
just south of it. Then
3 or 4 to reach 100, another, I don't know, 4 or 5 to reach 500. So definitely an acceleration there. I guess my question in that is you can't ever start your company on the exact right day.
No.
Maybe you can, maybe you're super lucky, but you're either too early or you're too late. And if you're too early, your job's to survive. And if you're too late, your job's to catch up. I think it's safe
to
say you guys are too early.
Yeah, yeah.
So maybe take us through that journey of like 2000, early 2000, starting the company and then hunkering down and trying to survive until the market caught up.
Yeah. The idea was not too early. The concept, so I'd been working in Silicon Valley doing some other technology work. And what I saw was the digitization of different industries. And so I saw the opportunity in construction to digitize. And look, I knew the internet wasn't at the job site. And I knew that the average construction management person graduating from a university is not going to be well-versed in technology. But I also knew that the industry and the processes that drove construction were so broken that this needed to happen. So I just started on the journey. And I knew it was early, but I was looking at the slope and I didn't know when we were going to hit that kind of tipping point. I thought it was going to happen faster, but I've just been this person I just saw something that I just knew had to happen. And to me, it was much more about solving the problem than it was about growing a big business. So there wasn't really a lot of like lamenting the, wow, we haven't hit a tipping point yet moments along the way. Now, there were times when we couldn't make payroll and, you know, times were tough, but like I still just believed in it. So I just kept doing it. And thank goodness I had a wife who didn't divorce me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so there's the picking the inevitability of something. And it's an interesting thing that I do as an exercise oftentimes is like, do I think this will happen? Mm-hmm. And you can get bogged down in the timing of like, why now and all that stuff. But if you think it's an inevitability, then it probably makes sense to get on the ride on that journey. So it sounds like you guys were early there, but you referenced not being able to make payroll. Were there times that you didn't think Procore would survive or what was the closest you came?
No, I just needed to get out and raise some more money. Frankly, I would never believe that we weren't going to survive. Well, I should say, there was an existential crisis in 2008, 2009, where even our most loving investors were like, we're not putting any money into construction technology. The world is falling apart, except for one, this gentleman, Kevin O'Connor, who's the founder of DoubleClick. He got it. And funny story about how I raised that money. But I was within hours of not being able to make payroll. And he was in the South China Sea on a cruise ship with his wife. And by the way, if you've ever had a challenge of trying to reach an investor, try calling a cruise ship, right? It's almost impossible, but I figured it out. I got him. He wired us some money. We made payroll, but he was my last call. I didn't know who else to call after him. And thank goodness he answered. And thank goodness he was in the casino and it was midnight when he got the phone call. Cause I think he was probably a little more open to the investment.
Yes. Yeah. Amenable to the circumstances.
Yeah.
Thank God for, I don't know, the blackjack hands that he got to feel comfortable.
He may have just won a few. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. The roulette wheel was spinning his direction. there were things you did to try to move the market along, including like installing Wi-Fi on job sites. And was that for, when you look back, was that just for your sanity at the end of the day? And there's really willing the market into existence was just to keep moving forward? Or do you think anything actually helped moving the market?
So I was having a hard time proving the business model because there was no internet at the job site. So my business idea wasn't about the internet at the job site. It was about providing, you know, data access to people at the job site. So in order for me to kind of prove my idea, like I just had to brute force getting the internet to the job site. But I will tell you when we flew into South Carolina, we flew in to South Carolina to go do that. This was the very first one we did. We went to, you know, Home Depot and got a toolbox, which was going to be the waterproof housing. Then we went to CompUSA and bought a router and a modem. And I remember climbing up borrowed a ladder from the electrician on the job site. Remember, this is a dirt lot that has a temporary power pole in it. So I'm climbing up this ladder and I'm thinking to myself, this probably looks really stupid. Like, you know, why, you know, we're charging like $95 a month and we're doing this. But I just had to be able to prove. And fortunately for us, we installed it on the job site of a gentleman who was really, really excited about the business model. He ended up investing in Procore and he told the world about it. So it was worth it. But boy, I felt silly at the time.
Yeah, going
we
up
did,
there.
We did. And by the way, I mean, I really got the start on the south side of LA, working with some kind of the Hollywood folks in their residences. And we installed every single one of those. We installed the internet at the job site, you know, crawling underneath trailers and stuff.
Well, and it was Ben Stiller and Barbara Streisand, right? Like, it was that the
first
next...
First one was Ben Stiller. Second one was Eddie Murphy. And then it was a whole cascade. The Barbara Streisand one stood out because she was so cool.
Yeah.
Like,
she was cool on site.
Like, yeah. She has kind of a reputation for maybe not being so easy. Mm. She was the coolest person I'd ever worked with. And I was like, I just remember that one because she sat us by the pool and served us icy and cookies.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So the business model evolution. So you were doing these custom homes for celebrities, essentially, right? I'm sure that wasn't your TAM, but it was a lot of big houses, I assume.
Well, what it was there still is today a handful of large custom home builders in Los Angeles that cater to the celebrities and the high net worth people down there. So I was working with those general contractors who would bring me to these celebrity sites.
And what year was this?
2001.
2001.
Yeah.
Okay. So,
yeah.
So after the internet bubble popped and so what was the evolution in going from these custom homes in LA to construction?
Well, that is construction.
Commercial construction.
Yeah. So the first kind of aha moment I had was, I remember standing up on the roof of Eddie Murphy's house in Beverly Park. And I looked, he had two structures and I looked down on one structure. And I don't know if you've ever been, well, you have, you're in New York. If you look down on a building below you, you'll see that there's a whole bunch of air conditioning unit on the roof of all those high rises, right? I looked down at Eddie Murphy's house and what I was looking at was what I thought would look like, you know, enough air conditioning unit for a casino. And I'm like, wow, this is not a residential project by any stretch. This is definitely and it was all commercial grade equipment. I'm like, we're actually doing commercial construction. And I didn't really think we were. And that's when the bit flipped. And I'm like, wait a minute, we don't have to be limited to high end residential. And there was a few missteps along the way, but we finally were able to enter that.
It's funny, segment. Eddie Murphy's house was equipped like a commercial
building. Yeah, yeah.
That's
I think
funny.
He had 23 air handlers on his roof.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, most people have one.
Yes. So you saw that, and then it was the global financial crisis that you're actually kind of forced to find your way into that market in a more meaningful way.
Yeah, we had a customer that was building a what's called mixed use, but it was residential upstairs and commercial downstairs, and we were really focused on the residential part of it. And then we realized, well, wait a minute, they're doing all this commercial work. And I'll never forget Steve Zahn, my co-founder, and I were we were talking about like, what are we going to do? All of our custom home builders are going out of business. Like, and it was, I don't know how much you remember of all this, but it was, nothing happened slowly in that time. Like people were, you know, every day, five customers would call and be like, you know, sorry, but I'm out of business. And so we're like, kind of like, what are we going to do? And we're like, let's just start calling, commercial contractors. And we did. And fortunately found a lot of early adopters that wanted to go with us. That was another one of those where we were just skimming the wave tops.
Yeah.
But I'll never forget too. So our pricing model was $95 a month per project. And of course that doesn't make payroll very well. So Steve Zahn looked at me and he's like, look, if we don't get $30,000 right now, we are going to go out of business. And so we're in this little tiny rental, office rental, and we're probably like 12 employees. And Mark Lyons, our sales rep, our one and only sales rep, called a lead that was in Salesforce. And at the end of the demo, we were all standing around this computer. This is before you did WebEx or whatever. It was just a phone call. he was talking about the benefits of Procore. The person said, how much does Procore cost? And Mark goes, $30,000 a year. And then we all sat back and the guy's like, all right, send me an invoice. We're going to make payroll. So that's actually how we actually changed our pricing model at that moment.
On the fly. Yeah. So the global financial crisis proved to be, I'm sure at the time, it felt like a major headwind to your business and you were kind of iterating. But twofold, I guess it helped you find your way to commercial construction in a more meaningful way. Like, what is it? Opportunity is the mother of invention or whatever.
It is. Yeah.
On the other hand, it also, a lot of competitors didn't survive there. Was there a recognition at that moment that this was actually an opportunity, or was it just...
No, because we were trying to survive. But what was interesting was before we went into the global financial crisis, we were in a sea of a lot of people had the same idea. And there was a lot of them. And there were companies that were bigger than us, more established. They had bigger customer brands associated with them. And it was really interesting because when you really are focused on what you're doing, trying to save the business, trying to survive, you don't really take a lot of time to poke your head up and look around. And on the backside, when we came up, literally the landscape was empty. Do you surf at all?
I don't.
So there's a thing called duck diving, which is you dive your board under a wave that's broken and you come up the backside, up the other side. I always just have this mental image is that, like, you know, the sea is full of surfers. We all duck dive. I come up the other side, I look around and no one else is there. Right. And that's kind of how the landscape looked at the time. It was barren.
Probably an interesting internalization for people that are burrowing down right now as founders and trying to get through what this is an interesting market, to say the least, right now. It's definitely been manic over the last couple of years. But the incremental venture-backed startup that has been funded in the last couple of years that you're competing with going away could actually really present the opportunity if you can survive this period of time, right?
Well, by the way, I think that's probably a great thing for founders to think about, which is all of the biggest inflection points in Procore came at our darkest hours. And you don't really think of it that way as a founder. You think it's a dark hour. But the reality is things are changing so rapidly that if you can actually adjust to the new world very quickly, you will accelerate your all of your vision that much faster.
Are there any other ones other than the global financial crisis that stand out? I assume COVID maybe is another one.
COVID was definitely one. There was also one around, it's kind of somewhat adjacent to this, but it was around culture, right? We got to a certain point when we moved to this campus in, I think, 2013 or 14, we were like 60 or 80 employees, enough that it was like too much for me to know everybody really, really well. And you know, at a certain point, you know, early on, you know, not only the person that's working for you, but you know, their spouse and their dog's name and everything else. At that point, I was starting to kind of not being able to know everybody as well as I could. And so we were deciding that we were going to, establish our mission, vision, and values so we can actually scale the business. And it was during that time that we made some hiring mistakes because we hadn't really established all of that yet. As a founder, you really have to develop very early on the skills of hiring great talent, but also being able to get rid of talent that's not effective. And I remember we were kind of in a crisis mode. We'd hired some wrong people and I needed to make some drastic changes. And when I did, lots of great things happened, right? So you struggle with making these decisions and having these conversations, but all of a sudden you come up the other side and you realize you're running faster than you were before. Everyone is way more engaged because these people are actually slowing you down. And then you have that aha moment that was not actually a dark time. That was actually a very, very important time for this business.
This is obvious to any founder, but I'm sure you live this. Any single bad employee, it spreads. It's like cancer. They then hire the next person and the culture starts to drift away. You guys went as far as to, Steve became, or his title now is Chief Cultural Officer, right?
Yeah, he's Chief Culture Officer, but he does so much more for Procore, but he's kind of my head sales guy these days. But I want to make sure that everyone's clear. He is not the owner of culture, but what he does is he's the ambassador for culture to ensure that everyone has the tools that they need to carry our culture forward, but yes.
So did you go through and at that point in time codify like what the values were and what had drifted from it? Or what did you do other than managing those people out?
Yeah.
Like what was the post-mortem changes you made?
So we shut the business down for 2 whole days, which, by the way, when you're 60 people and you're barely making payroll, that's a big, but I'm like, I want to get this right. I used to work in Silicon Valley for in HR software, which had nothing to do with this industry. And I would just see these businesses that had horrible cultures. And I'm like, I don't want to ever grow that. I want to make sure we get this right. So we went off site and we facilitated a meeting with our, I think our leaders at the time was like 10 people. And we went through our mission, our vision, and our values. And it basically codified who we were. And it's a process, but it's really important. In fact, we do a thing called Culture Academy here where we bring our people that build on our platform, our partners. We bring in the ones that are most engaged and adopted by our customers onto campus, like I think twice a year. And we help them build their mission, vision, and values because it's so critical at the early stage to get that right.
Hiring against it, do you end up breaking people into different teams that assess certain elements of the culture? Or is there a single person that's responsible for holistically, will they fit into the culture? Or how do you actually actualize it?
At different stages, we did different things. Early on, Steve and I were doing all of it. And as we grew, we would find folks that were really good at certain aspects of it. But you also, you know, early on, you have to still test for aptitude. So you really, you know, at our scale today, if you're, you know, if a resume makes it to our desk, you pretty much have the skill set to do the job. So we really now focus mostly on the kind of the values hiring. But as we grew, it became more and more kind of, it was really more like, hey, Gabe, who is running our customer success group, he is really, really good with openness and ownership. Like he's really good at, and so we would put him on it. And it was a gang tackle. But we would even do things like, when we had a candidate come in to LAX to come up to Santa Barbara to interview for a job, the car service that would pick them up is actually a friend of mine. And so he would drive them up and he would overhear their conversations and he would hear how he would tell me how they treated him as the driver. And so long before that candidate actually got here, I knew all about how, like what they were really like and if they were really living our values or if they weren't. So we tried every tactic in the book to make sure we didn't get it wrong.
What specifically broke? Like what was the red blinking light at that point in time?
I don't think, well, like I said, we had made some challenging hires, but it was less what broke. It was more about, I had so much faith in where this business was going that I knew if we didn't get the foundation right, we were going to have a real hard time. Those businesses I was working for in the Bay Area when I was doing HR software were Fortune 50 companies. Most of them had fundamentally broken cultures and they couldn't put Humpty Dumpty back together again. And I'm like, I don't want to get to the point where I'm fixing my culture. So if we just start with people, because people are the root of all your culture, and get that right, then we won't have to fix the problem later.
If you're a founder and maybe you feel that there's some element of this, or you're asking yourself, hey, there's 5 or 8 people that I don't know if they totally fit in, but they're, you know, they're doing a good job and they're high performant or whatever. Is there any question you would ask yourself? Like, hey, if you're asking the question, the answer is probably yes, or yep, something along those lines that you would recommend?
So I mentor some founders, and across the board, everyone is, has, especially the younger ones, have not developed the skills of how to assess and jettison people that aren't working. And they will make all of these mental gymnastics around why they should keep the person. That is a fundamental flaw because across the board, they will eventually fail. And so really what you're doing is you're just extending the amount of damage that this person is going to do to your business. Because ultimately what you want is you want a force multiplier in that seat that's not going to just, obviously you don't want them to slow you down. You want them to actually accelerate you and make you better. So yeah, I tell founders all the time, like, do not make excuses. You, by the way, we all know, and they all know what the right answer is. It's just hard to do the work. You know, it's funny, and I've had to say goodbye to lots and lots of people over the years as this company grew. But I've always told myself that ultimately Procore is bigger than me and it's bigger than them. And if we are going to deliver on the promise, we have to make difficult choices. And, you know, I'm not excluded from that. If I'm not doing my job or there's somebody that's better to do this job than I am, I trust and I know the board will make that change and it's not personal.
I've heard you say specifically that you hire for a certain set of traits, which are hungry, humble, and smart.
Yeah.
How do you think about this? And are there interview questions that you've operationalized?
Well, so as I mentioned, the driver By the way, I'm giving all my tactics away. So now people that hire
me, this will be a primer to trick you at this point.
The driver is definitely on the humble side. Like, is this person actually who they kind of come across to be?
The driver's assessing that.
The driver's giving me all of that on the way up. Generally, the smart's not a problem because, again, if you coming into Procore, you've demonstrated that you've had success somewhere. But the hunger too is really important. And what I've found is you can find hungry and smart, but you're going to probably get an asshole, right? You need the humble in there. And you can get the, you know, hungry and humble, but if they're not smart enough to do so, in other words, that triumvirate, you have to have all three of them and you can't compromise on them ever, but it really works. And I just love simple paradigms like that, that you can kind of live by. And by the way, that's how I choose my friends too, frankly. There's something about it that, just works.
Yeah. So smart is a certain level of competency, and you could probably look at, you know, whatever different resume related things on that, or maybe it just comes out in the conversation. The humble side, you've got your driver that helps on that. What about hungry? Like,
that's the hardest one. It's funny. I was having this conversation at dinner last night with one of our customers, but, how everyone claims to be hungry, but are they? It's very hard to assess that. What I normally do is I spend a lot of time on curiosity, because the more curious somebody is, usually the more kind of energy they're going to bring to their job, because they just are curious. So I spend a lot of time in the interview process just talking about what people are passionate about and see if they have a hunger around something outside of Procore. And usually that comes out pretty quickly.
I've sort of found that there's football players and basketball players, and football players, you tell them what to do and they execute on it. And that has a good role. Basketball players, you need to be able to move and create and all that. And within an organization, especially in the early days, if you can't create and juke and jive and go with the flow on stuff, it's going to be really hard for that person to be successful. And so one of the questions I'll always ask is like, what is an entrepreneurial thing that you took from zero to one? And it doesn't matter if you're an investment banking first year analyst or you're whatever, you're an executive. If you've never taken something from zero to one organizationally in some way, you're probably not going to make it in a startup or a venture job as well. Venture, like, you know, our calendar is blank every day and you need to justify something to keep going. It could be a podcast. It could be, you know, meeting the incremental founder and all that. But if you don't have that, it's really hard to start.
Yeah, it's funny. We were fortunate when we first started, as we found a lot of, by the way, motivate. There's a lot of things that motivate people to kind of have that hunger in them, and also wanting to kind of prove that they can do something. They have a little bit of a chip on their shoulder. So we're sitting here in Santa Barbara, California, right? The ocean's right there. UCSB is where we hired most of our early people from. And a lot of those folks come from towns like Fresno, California, Bakersfield, California, you know, places where these kids who've gone to school here for 4 years learn how to surf, love the beach or whatever, they graduate and the fear of God comes over and they're like, oh my God, I got to go back to Fresno or Bakersfield. I don't want to go. And so we would find these people that would do anything to stay in this town. And so you find that by itself just separates people, which is these are the people that will fight and scrape to make something happen in the absence of you know, any help from outside.
I heard you say something interesting about the risk in starting a company. And I think what you said, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you need to have a unique insight and a non-consensus view of something that's going to happen, but that the number of things you need to believe will happen is exponentially correlated with the risk of the opportunity.
Yep.
It's sort of it's intuitive when you think about it, but like the number of things you need to believe, there's this Andy Ratcliffe quote about like, or view that there's an onion and each time you're trying to peel layers off the onion to de-risk the opportunity.
Right.
How do you think about that and how does it relate to Procore?
Well, a lot of things had to go right, right? By the way, I stole that from I don't know if you listen to the Acquired podcast.
But yeah, of course.
I forget if it was Charlie Munger, maybe some, by the way, I'm such a huge Charlie Munger fan.
Yeah,
so sad.
Who isn't,
So sad that he passed away. But but taking that concept, it really kind of struck a chord with me because so many things would had to have happened in order to make Procore, you know, actually work. The fact that there was no internet at the job site was a huge deal for, you know, you think about it. 3G was really what actually allowed the internet to get to the job site. That didn't happen for like, I don't know, 8 years until after we started the company. So many things had to happen. You had to have that. You had to have, kids that had graduated from college that were kind of pressing and adopting for technology. You really had to have the iPhone. You had to, in 2007, you had to have the iPad in 2011. All these things had to happen. We had to survive. We had to make payroll. It's kind of a little scary when you kind of rewind the tape, the game tape, and you're like, wow, like we had to fly through so many, you know, small apertures in order to make this work. And so I guess I think of it that way. I'm kind of glad I didn't think of it that way back then, because it might have been too daunting for me.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. A lot of different things had to go right along the way. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Logan Bartlett Show with Tooey Courtemanche. If you enjoyed this conversation with Tooey or other episodes like it, we really appreciate you sharing with other people you think might find this interesting. We're trying to grow the show, so each incremental share or subscription on whatever platform you're listening on really helps. We talked a little bit about the number of competitors you guys had in the early days. Some did survive, I assume, and some new ones entered the market. From an execution standpoint, how did you beat the other people in the market?
Well, a couple things. One was we got really lucky to be a platform in 2002. If you think about it, like SaaS wasn't even a word called SaaS, right? But we kind of ended up being a platform by accident. When I started Procore, I was used to in Silicon Valley in these Fortune 500, Fortune 50 companies, we would show up on site and we would install an Oracle database, right? Well, these are Fortune 50 companies. They can afford Oracle databases. But when I started Procore, I couldn't afford to spin up an Oracle database for every one of our new customers that was paying us $95 a month. So what I had to do was create a single instance of a code base on a single server. And I did that by just putting a company ID in front of every database table that I had created in the database. And so we got kind of lucky that actually happened, very early on in our journey. And so being a platform allowed us to scale. So that,
to interrupt you, but what does a platform actually mean in this regard?
Right? Yeah.
It's single backend database or a bunch of constituents in it or ability to build applications?
It's a single code base, multi-tenant architecture, that really allowed me to run the entire business off of a single server at the time. So if, my next incremental customer, all I had to do was add an incremental count to the company ID in the database and, you know, I could spin them up. So the incremental cost to bringing them online was next to zero.
And there's probably something about like the core operating system as well that allows you to then build modules on the extension.
Yes. And you know, I certainly am not the best engineer in the world, but I got it right. I got it right enough, I guess, is the right way to put it. Being able to spin up a customer quickly, very inexpensively, was a competitive advantage that most of the people that were doing what we're doing were not doing that. They were doing a hosted solution where each customer would get their own instance of the code base. And I think that was a big boat anchor on our competitors.
And by the way, not to, sometimes people are dismissive of competitors in that, but that probably made sense from their vantage point because they were servicing, I assume, maybe a higher end of the market. And so they could build the custom stuff.
By the way, I actually think that was just what you did, right? There was no other motion. Nobody at that time, I shouldn't say nobody. I think there was a couple companies in the Bay Area that were doing this. I mean, obviously Salesforce had done this, but the pattern for this particular business model had not really been established yet. So, and again, I did it only because that was the only thing I could afford to do. If I had more money and I had more momentum with the business early on, I probably would have chosen the other architecture because it was the predominant architecture of the time. Hmm.
So you raised from angels and Kevin O'Connor and a few other folks along the way, but your first institutional round came from Bessemer in what year was that?
2015, I think.
2015. And you were about $9.6 million I have down here very precisely $9.6 million in
Sounds
revenue
right
at
me.
That point in time. What led you to pursuing outside investment from an institutional investor?
I'll never forget. We were, Steve Zahm and I were talking about the fact that we actually, there's a time in all founders' experience where their passion starts to see like green shoots where you're like, wait a minute, you know, not only do I believe in this, but like other people believe in this and they're actually, you know, paying me money. And I think Steve kind of made fun of me because I'm a product CEO first and foremost, like, and I'm just I love the customer and the product. You know, Steve kind of made fun of me one day where he's like, you know, we ought to probably try to sell this software. Like, you know, you're building the software and you're, you know, driving in your Jeep Grand Cherokee down, knocking on trailer doors and, you know, we, whatever. But I think it's time that we actually start doing this. And so I'm like, okay, well, I've never done this before. Steve had taken his last company public, a company called Digital Think. So fortunately for me, I paired myself with somebody who was far smarter than me and had a lot more experience in this world than I did. And so Steve basically laid the groundwork for this process. And we thought, you know what, if we could ladle some capital onto this business, we have proven that the folks that are buying our software love it, but no one knows about it. So like the obvious investment need was to kind of spread the word. And I think that's where like Bessemer and Iconic both came in, and they're like, wow, this is, you know, they would do customer calls and whatever. And they're like, this is a company that just really needs a go-to-market engine. And if they do, this might be something big.
So at that point in time, I think I heard you say Bessemer underwrote the outcome or like the upside case to $300 million like as an acquisition or something. And now, whatever, 8 years later, you're doing 2x that in recurring revenue alone or something close.
Three, excuse me.
3x that. And as you sort of zoomed out and went and got poked and prodded by different investors at that point in time, like what, when you dreamed the dream, was $300 million the number that made sense? Or what were you, I'm sure it wasn't $900 million in recurring revenue, but.
No, if I rewind the game tape a little bit, like 2 years prior to that, I'll never forget, we were in a really small office in Montecito where we were before this campus. And Steve Zahm was standing in his office. I think we probably had maybe 12 employees or whatever. And I walked in and he was like writing on his whiteboard a whole bunch of numbers. And he said to me, he goes, hey, Tui, I really think that this business someday could be worth $100 million. And I was like, you're shitting me. There's no way. Like, you know, and he's like, no. And by the way, I always look to Steve as he's the Stanford grad. He's, you know, he went to Haas. He's like, he knows the answers, right? I'm like, wow, that's really cool. And so then fast forward a couple of years, now we're up talking to Bessemer and everyone else. And by the way, I didn't know about this $300 million story, which by the, I got in trouble, by the way, for saying this. I wasn't supposed to know this.
Oh,
and
funny.
So somebody on the inside told me this. And so anyway, but I've said it, so I'm going to say
it's in public
record. It's in public record now, so I'm going to say it. But
I'm going to edit out all the nice things about Bessemer and Iconic, and I'm going to put in all the, you know, the underestimating of you guys in there. So.
So anyhow, you know, I didn't really know what their investment thesis was, of course, because that's not really shared with us. But I had a feeling this could be big. I never in my wildest dreams envisioned this. You know, good on them. If they thought we were worth, you know, the possible $300 million in the future, then, you know, they had a good eye.
Yeah. Well, I want to come back to the founder journey in a bit, but operating the business. Now, how many people do you guys have?
South of 4,000.
Yep. And in 2015, it was...
I think it was like 90. Between 60 and 90. Something
yeah.
Like
so
that.
So in 9 years, quite an exponential growth. So I one of the things, I guess there's two different approaches to leadership and style. One is that you try to shore up your weaknesses, and one is you hire people to augment your weaknesses. Yeah. Which one of those two do you believe in more?
It's not a binary answer. I think it's an 80-20 rule, but I think 80% you have to hire for to augment your weaknesses. I do think that if you're going to be successful as an individual in life and in business and everything else, you have to have a desire to grow personally. So I think it can't be 100-0. But I do believe that one of my strengths is recognizing my weaknesses and knowing who to surround. Finding Steve Zahm, for instance. I'm Procore would have been out of business long ago if I was in charge of the checkbook, right? Because all I want to do is build product and satisfy customers' needs. So I think it's really important that you surround yourself with people that actually do augment that. And you know, the biggest privilege, Logan, is that I have, at this scale, I come to work every day and I'm literally humbled and kind of blown away by the caliber of the talent that I'm able to surround myself with because of the success we've had. It's really rewarding and I'm learning every single day and I love it.
One of the things I also heard is you've removed yourself from deal negotiations with customers. When did that happen and why did you do it?
There's two stories. There's behind that. One is that it was probably about five, actually, you know what? It's probably more, it's probably like 7 or 8 years ago. I was the primary deal negotiator, right? And I think I had been in too many difficult negotiations where at the end, I didn't have a great relationship with my buyer. And so I was in partner. And so I had the revelation. Plus, I had brought on Dennis Landers, the head of sales, and he was so good. And you know, he understood the whole process of the science behind selling. And mine was much more relationship building. So I saw him do it. And I'm like, I want him to do that. Plus, I really wanted to develop a strong personal partnership connection with my peer. And not have it be a transactional relationship. And the model then, and very similar to today, was we renew most of our customers on an annual basis. I didn't want to have to like put on my sales hat and go do it. I have a much deeper relationship with our customers because I don't do this. Because they know when I call them, I'm not trying to sell them something. Hmm. Yeah. And by the way, the business doesn't suffer for it. Now, they do actually let me spike the ball, which is fun. So they'll do all this hard work and these long deal cycles or whatever. Towards the end, I'm building relationships with their executives and they'll let me come in and like, you know, ring the bell. And
you're holding the jumbo check.
Exactly. And I feel like I did all the work. And but of course, all the people did the rest of the work.
That's good. You've been fortunate enough to have some very impressive mentors in the technology ecosystem, one of which Toby Lukey from Shopify. And I'd heard he imparted some advice that I'd be curious your perspective on, but involving, and you alluded to this earlier, that you're not immune from, if you're not performing, potentially being replaced. But there's a slope of the line of the company, and then there's the slope of the line that you need to grow at as the leader of the business. How do you think about that, and how has that advice impacted you?
It's funny. It's not just a leader. Everybody at the business has got to grow with the. His advice was too. If the business is growing 100% a year, you and your team's skill set has to grow beyond that. Right.
Yeah.
That's not going to be enough to grow at 100%, which, by the way, is hard. And so that really stuck with me as time went on. That there's never a time to be complacent in your growth. And so I, till this day, I look at myself every day and, you know, what am I doing to, you know, be a better leader? Mm. And so you're never done with it. The sad part about it is that you end up having to say goodbye to a lot of people along the way that got you here. And I think there's a real art to how you make those separations. And I think we're pretty good at it, but you have to be real. And, you know, some founders think that they're going to kind of keep people around and just give them kind of a soft landing. It is the worst thing you can do. You need to be direct and honest and open with your employees. If they're not scaling, just say, hey, I'm going to help you find another job somewhere else. And we call them graduates. People are going to graduate from here and go somewhere else. And, you know, but yes, you have to be prepared to make those changes because not everybody, I mean, frankly, most people can't scale at that pace. Somebody said to me the other day, like, there's not a lot of founders out there that are running a $1 billion business that they founded because it takes such a completely different skill set. And so I've spent a lot of time trying to develop those skills. And really part of it is not only the skills you develop, but the skills that you leave behind, right? What got me here in the early days, this kinetic energy of doing everybody's job for them and running in 1,000,000 miles an hour in different directions, it is not effective at scale.
The tactical insight from that point, because it's a very hard moment in the journey that you're talking about of the executives that got you there aren't going to be who get you there in the future. So it sounds like being real with them about it, not trying to, you know, dance around it, and actually moving on, graduating them from the company rather than trying to repurpose them. Are those the fair insights? Is there anything else that you guys have learned about how to do it?
Well, I got, so yes, one piece that kind of helps me with this was I have the opportunity once a quarter to talk to Satya Nadella as a mentor. And one of the very first pieces of advice, I was kind of struggling with my leadership team and thinking about like, how do I think about my leadership team? I mean, at the time we were a much smaller company, but we're here in Santa Barbara and I don't have exposure to a lot of different kind of peers in the same scale and situation that I was in. And I said, how do you think about this? How do you think about your team? And he goes, it's really hard to, you know, really assess your team because you're so close to them. He said, so what he does, and he goes, what I think you should do is always be in conversations with peers of your leaders. So like once a quarter, have a conversation with a head people officer somewhere else that you respect and admire, a chief revenue officer somewhere else that you respect and admire. And it really helps create a, and by the way, this is, I wish I had known him many, many years ago and had done this earlier. It really helps to create a contrast between who you have in the seat versus what's available out in the market, or maybe not even available, but what's out there in the market. And it helps you get a real decision very quickly as to the skill and the scale of your talent that you have on hand. So having that piece, that tool in my toolbox really, really works.
How do you keep your employees motivated to the ambition of where the company is and where it needs to go? Because if you're in San Francisco, you have OpenAI over there and you have Stripe over here and you have Facebook down the corner and Apple and all that. But here, Procore in Santa Barbara is the huge fish. And I'm sure when they go home to their, or go out to drinking with their buddies, like, you know, they've made it. They're at a far bigger scale of a business than a lot of the other local companies. Not to say there aren't other good businesses here, but keeping them aware that the mission is beyond, you know, what they see in Santa Barbara, but it's a global ambition. Is there any way that you found to do that?
Well, it's probably the hardest thing you can do. But in the early days, it's easier because everyone feels it's us against the world, right? But driving a sense of purpose into your organization where, you know, the average tenure at Procore is, you know, less than 5 years, right? So how do you get these folks, you know, engaged? And there's not one trick, right? But it does start with hiring the right people. Steve has this thing, which is the team hires and fires. So you really do, you have to assemble the right groups of people in order to make it to be a place that people want to come to every day. And so hiring to the values really matters. But driving a sense of purpose into the organization through your mission and vision, we have a lot of people here that really do believe in what we're trying to do here, improve the lives of everyone in construction, as well as just being engaged. And the engagement, one of the big tricks that we have is we encourage every Procore employee to go to job sites. Just go sit in the job site trailer for a half day and learn, you know, see the whites of the eyes of the person whose problems you're solving for. And you will, the people that we hire tend to be like, I'm in this, I'm going to solve for this. And a couple of great examples. One is we send engineers to job sites, you know, instead of sitting in the darkness of their engineering room, they're sitting around job sites watching the people use the software that they build every day. We tend to get engineers that will, there may be a feature enhancement that customers have been asking for a while. Engineer sees it in real life. They will code and ship that code on an airplane on the way home from that job site, right? Because that level of engagement is so high. Today, we have 36 of our largest customers here on site. I'm encouraging everybody that possibly can be here at Procore to be in that room to really get a sense of what they are. So driving a sense of purpose and engagement it's hard. And, you know, it's, like I said, it's easy in the early days. The real trick is when you're shifting from first into second gear, which is we are now big enough where people might not get it or whatever. So you have to really do everything you can to drive that kind of engagement and not assume that there's a better job offer right down the road that somebody might take.
Yeah, it's sort of like families with generational wealth. Like the first one makes it, second one saw how hard they worked, and the third one messes it up and blows it. You know, it's one of those things you got to be cognizant of.
My grandfather used to say, shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations. You know, you work in the field, you know, make some money, and then, you know, the next generation spins it, and then the next generation has to go back to work in the field. So
good. That's a good lesson. What are the important jobs of being a CEO as capital allocator across the business? How do you think about new initiatives and where to put money, what to invest in, all that?
Yeah. So there's obviously lots of frameworks out there you can use to do that. We do the Horizons framework, so that helps a lot when we think about where to make investments.
Maybe for people that don't know, like, can you give the brief?
So Crossing the Chasm, Zones to Win, Jeffrey Moore. Jeffrey's come and spoken to us about it. It's just a good framework, the four zones. And it's basically from the core of your business that you can't break all the way through these future investments that you want to make and how you allocate capital across those four zones. And for us, we are very disciplined over, you know, which zone we're going to put capital into. So we kind of start with our capital allocation at that level. How much do we have to invest and where are we going to put it? So we don't, you want to avoid over-investing in the long-term over the horizon opportunities, but you want to make sure that you put the proper investments in the ones that are really going to pay dividends today. So, and so we use that as a framework where to start putting our capital. But it gets harder and harder the bigger you get with capital allocation, because, you know, we service a global economy, and there's, you know, owners, general contractors and subcontractors. There's the enterprise or mid-market, the SMB. There's the US market and these other markets that we're in, all of which have needs for resources in order to solve their needs. So it gets more and more challenging as you do so. But as long as you use a framework, and we use that framework, you will get the big pieces right. The other thing as a capital allocator for a CEO is, it's not just the capital you're going to, you know, that you're going to put into the business today, but like for Procore, we have to think about the capital that we have that we have to, you know, invest, right? So it's the capital that we have on the balance sheet that's not going to go into the business today. So it actually even gets more complicated as you get bigger. The good news is that if you're disciplined, you will probably be right. And the other thing is that I do two things. I come up with the capital allocation and the strategy with input from my leaders. And then I have them do a bottoms up and then challenge me on that. And within that challenge comes out the answer. And that tends to be the right answer. So we do find ourselves throughout the year making small tweaks to that, because you learn things and some things don't work. But also in the horizon four items that are over the horizon, that are the big bets, you tend to make shifts on those pretty quickly, because they're essentially startups in your organization. You're learning something new every single day.
So as you guys have built more and more product surface area, and I don't know, how many products do you guys have today?
11.
11. So as you get those off the ground and empowering innovation and people to be entrepreneurial in what they're going after while maintaining the consistency of what is the Procore platform, do you end up empowering like a GM type role to go after that, and they get some cross-functional resources? Or what have you found about launching new products?
So our business itself is very matrix. So we do have people that are focused on owners and the product organization, general contractors and specialty contractors. But the challenges that we're solving for across those three stakeholders, there's in the Venn diagram, there's about an 80% overlap. So it doesn't make sense to have them focus on the commonalities and the platform features that kind of cross those things. So we do have, it's very matrix, but yes, we do have people that focus on the different stakeholders, because the differences between each one of those stakeholders can be pretty big. You know, what an owner needs is far different than what a subcontractor needs. So we do, but they're not, it's not really a GM model. It's more of a specialized focus model. And you know, the Conway's law that you ship the code that represent that mimics your org design. We've learned that lesson over the years too. If you over engineer your org design incorrectly, you'll end up with a very inefficient product that is not going to market effectively. So we've learned that it's really important to get your org design right. That's one of the areas where I spend a lot of time thinking, because as a business evolves, org design matters. When you go from a US business to an international business, how you organize your teams gets really, really complicated. So, I org design matters.
On the international point, like what are the lessons in that and the org design point you were alluding to there?
So, it's really interesting, but from Procore's standpoint, when we were in 2017, we went to Australia, New Zealand, and Canada. What we thought was going to happen was not what happened. It was a new motion for Procore. Obviously, we're a US company. We hadn't done this before. And what we learned was we were kind of spoiled by being a known brand in the US market. And we kind of showed up, and this is being euphemistic, we kind of showed up in these new regions thinking like, we're here, you know, and everyone's like, that's great. Who are you? You know?
Yeah.
So what we learned along the way was the team that does the beachhead landing org design has got to be a very small, tight, autonomous team that basically can find the referenceable customers, do the brand marketing, build the brand, and start building this organization. But much like when you invest in a small startup, it very quickly gets to the point where you actually need a more of a formal design, because that's not going to get you to the next level. So you have to be, as a leader, you have to remember that though you have a mature organization here in the US, that little startup has got to be, their talent has to evolve and probably has to change out as you grow. So you, that's the talent side. And on the org design side, you definitely need somebody back at corporate headquarters that is helping them get the resources that they need in order to be successful. And we learned that somewhat of the hard way because if they don't get the resources they need, they can't be successful. But it's also hard to listen to a 5-person team when you're running hard and fast in this market.
So do you send someone from HQ to the local market and then hire in people with the cultural expertise as well? Or how do you make that work?
That has worked really well for us. Primarily because of the people and the culture aspect of it. We basically are transplanting a portion of Procore down there. That has worked very, very well for us, both in Australia, New Zealand, and in UK, Ireland, and Canada. Yeah. So that works.
There's a trade-off that exists with expediency of decision making. And on the other hand, there's refinement of inputs.
Yes.
And those two things are at odds with one another. How do you think about this trade-off and being assertive and decisive, but also methodical and thoughtful?
It's not an exact science at all. My style is I like to gather probably more information than most before I make a decision, but I'm also very principled. So I know where I stand on the important pieces, and on the pieces that are newer to me or the blast radius is smaller, I'm going to take more time trying to understand. It's not really consensus building, but as you grow, you hire people who know more about their function than you do. So I really try to just ask the right questions and listen. I have this whole thing around inquiry over advocacy. I would much rather sit in a meeting as a leader and ask for input as opposed to tell everybody what the answer is. And some leaders actually are the opposite. They know the answer. They go in and tell everybody how to do their job. And we've hired people from large companies that you would know the brand of, that the CEO runs the business that way, who are very uncomfortable with my leadership style because I'm very, very open and I want to hear people's input before I commit to a decision. Now, as my wife likes to say, the indecision is the decision. So you can't not make a decision. And actually it's funny, Steve and I used to always say, people would ask us why we're successful. And we would say, we make one better decision every single day than all the bad decisions we make, but the key is that we make the decisions.
Yeah.
And we also look at problem spaces with the blast radius in mind. So we very much consider what the impact's going to be.
Yeah.
And that's critical.
What about balancing growth and profitability? You've seen this pendulum swing back and forth and you've gone from more bootstrappy to more high growth. How do you think about that?
Yeah. So we actually are very fortunate to have lived through the phase of the market the way we have, which was for the first, 19 years of Procore's history, it was grow, 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 market share, market share, market share. And for a business, a vertical SaaS business like Procore that's in an industry where it's going to be winner takes most, that really matters. So we had the latitude to grow kind of at all costs, right? Now, two things happened to Procore. One was in 2009, we ran out of money and nobody was going to invest any more money in Procore. So we had to get really scrappy, by the way, in the early days, we had no money too, but Steve and I know how to be capital efficient because we had to, right? And so over the years, we've had to have that. So it's kind of in our DNA to be capital efficient, but then we were growing, growing, growing. And then it was around 3 or 4 years ago where we started saying, okay, well, there are significant operational efficiencies that we can wring out of this business and not hamper our growth. And so we started doing that. Now, we started at like negative 35% operating margins. So we had a long way to go. And we were marching along there. And then along the way, the world that you live in changed their mind and decided that it was all that mattered was profitability. And the good news was we already had started on that journey and we had been marching away and giving back operating margin more and more over time. And here we are and, delivering significant operating margin last year and again this year. But we never do it at the expense of growth. So to answer your question, we prioritize growth over operating margin slightly. So if we ever see an opportunity to grow this business, we're going to make the investment if we feel confident in it. And fortunately for us, there's a lot of things we can do. But we also know that the more we focus, allocating less capital can actually speed you up. Mm-hmm. And that is very unintuitive to a lot of founders, but it's actually true. Scarcity actually drives velocity, and it's just something that we know. And so we don't feel like we're sacrificing anything. And you know, we came up with this term efficient growth, which is kind of just what we run the business off of. And when I said that to the leadership team, like, look, our new mantra here is efficient growth. We need to make every decision kind of through that lens. I was wondering, like, am I going to be fighting my leaders on this? Because they're going to be like, no. And, you know, the good news was at Procore, they adopted it, and then it went throughout the entire organization. So we have people making decisions around not doing a catered lunch, right? Which we normally would do, and just going and doing a regular lunch and doing things like that that actually matter all the way through the organization.
Hmm. Was there a single all hands or something that you like really galvanized around it? And was it hard for some people to shift that mindset?
Well, I think, and that's my takeaway, was it was surprisingly easy for this organization. I'm not 100% certain why. I'm grateful that it was. I can't think of one difficult conversation I had with one leader around the fact that they weren't getting it.
Hmm. That's interesting.
Yeah.
What advice do you wish you had about running a business that you would give to founders today, or that you do give to founders today in the role of being a mentor to early stage companies?
There's nothing that matters. Well, first, you have to have a good product and you have to have big TAM, right? But beyond that, nothing matters more than people. And so you can be fixated on, I know founders that get very fixated on their mission and they don't spend enough time thinking about the people, but it's all about talent, and you just have to get really, really good at that. And you have to get real fast. So I've developed a very strong muscle over the years and how to, you know, attract and retain top talent, and also to jettison poor talent. But I wish I had a mentor early on who kind of taught me that, because everything I learned somewhat the hard way.
Yeah.
I wish somebody would have helped me with that. So I spent a lot of time with founders trying to figure out how to teach them that.
Pricing is an important derivative of all things related to the business. And you guys made a conscious decision in the early days to pursue volume-based pricing versus seat-based pricing. I guess this is maybe a little bit of a, the specifics of it might be a little niche and bespoke to your industry or how you guys think about it. But can you talk through that that decision and how that downstream sort of impacted a bunch of business considerations as well?
Yeah. So this is will sound strange to most people that aren't in our business, but we have volume-based pricing. So if you're a general contractor doing $100 million a year, you'll pay a certain basis points based on the number of products of ours that you run on an annual basis. But let me back up and tell you how we got there. First and foremost, this business is all about connecting everyone in construction on a global platform. Owners, GCs, and subs, and material and equipment suppliers, and insurers, and lenders, everybody that's involved in a project. Everybody has got to be in the same ecosystem, sharing the same workflows and the same data. I knew when I started Procore that if I did a per seat license model, which was really the only pricing model that existed at the time, that our customers were going to start making value decisions around, Logan doesn't need a license. He's only going to be on the job for whatever. And then all these workflows would break and my vision wasn't going to happen. So I knew early on that that wasn't going to work. So I remember talking to an early customer who was using a client server solution that was dominant in the industry at the time. And they were a seat license business. And he's like, well, I'm going to leave this platform, not platform, this client server environment. I'm coming to Procore. And, you know, how much is it going to cost? And I'm like, well, I'm still trying to come up with a yardstick, right? So I said, how much volume are you doing every year? I think I said, how much construction are you doing every year? And he goes, oh, that's really interesting you ask that, because I buy my insurance based on my construction volume that I do. And he said, you know, if you're thinking about how to measure my business versus a competitor or another business, construction volume is a really good indicator of the size and scale of the business. And so all I did at that point was I took his per seat licensing model and it was like $35,000 for X number of seats. And then his volume. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to back into an equation that comes up with the number of basis points that equates to what he's paying per seats. And that was the genesis of our pricing model. And it was hard in the beginning. And frankly, it's even hard sometimes today for customers to buy into that. But CFOs love it because it actually, they only buy what they're going to use. And it gives them the ability to kind of manage their consumption. As opposed to it just being a bunch of licenses that aren't getting used.
And it's aligned with their success, right? Or their scale and their growth rather than headcount, I assume, is a little bit orthogonal in some ways to the outcome.
It's exactly aligned with their scale of their business. Their success and our success are very much aligned.
Yeah. I want to back all the way up to your path to starting Procore.
Okay.
I would say we talked about Steve. Steve had a very traditional, probably Silicon Valley, Stanford experience. You did not. It wasn't the traditional educational path to being an entrepreneur. Can you talk about early days and college and what led you to the Procore?
Yeah. It's interesting as you kind of get to this point in life when you reflect on your on everything that happened to you. When I was in high school, it was very clear that I was not a good student. I was curious, but I was only curious about the things I was curious about. And so it turns out, I have a reading disability and also that I'm what you would call like an autodidact. You give me something that I'm passionate about and I will become an expert on it in just a number of days. In fact, right now I'm going through a course right now to become a timber frame carpenter. So I'm going to build a timber frame barn. And so I'm learning all of the joinery and everything else. So like, that's my personality type. Society wasn't built for people like us, right? We didn't fit the mold. My guidance counselor in high school was like, I don't know what to do with you. You know, anyway, I go to University of Arizona and I get distracted and I essentially get kicked out. And so then I have to figure out what I'm going to do. And so I go and become a security guard at my grandfather's building where he lived in an assisted living situation and decided that I didn't want to do that. So I went back to community college and I got a 4.0 because I realized it wasn't about anything other than the fact I wanted to prove to the world that I was freaking smart. So I just brute forced my way through some community college classes and I did pretty well. Ended up being accepted into University of San Francisco's pre-med program. Went up to the Bay Area to do that. I had a few months before the fall semester began. Got a job working in construction. I'd grown up in construction. I knew construction and I'm passionate about construction. Anyway, the fall came and I decided that it wasn't time for me to go to school because I was having so much fun building. I essentially never went back. So I'm essentially a college dropout without any of that experience. But I found Steve and Steve had all the credentials and he was, he was just a great partner to kind of bring all of that kind of credibility and learnings.
Is there a, I guess follow your passion and find what you're uniquely interested in, but is there any, lesson you would impart? You have a son, that you have shared in that whole thing that's interesting for people?
Well, I think it's know thyself, right? I know my weaknesses. If you're not going to be a doctor or a lawyer or an accountant or whatever, and you don't need to get a four-year degree, the sooner you recognize that, the better. Because now you're in the camp of, I have to develop a skill of some sort. And hopefully you have some passion around something that you can develop a skill around. But I think it's really important that we find a place for the people that have as much passion and horsepower as I have, to have a place in the society where they can actually contribute. A lot of founders are similar to me. They don't fit into the normal mold. But if you empower those people to actually go do what they're meant to do, you can get a lot out of them.
It seems like we've maybe over rotated or definitely rotated pretty far to the 4-year liberal arts, school degrees instead of the more practical, applicable things that translate to direct jobs in there. I know you are passionate about this, but can you speak about like that?
Well, yeah. So I'm so passionate about this. Like for instance, one of the biggest crimes in America is the fact that we took shop class out of high school. I remember, you know, shop class was just, you know, it taught me so much about how to work with my hands and gave me so much confidence that I could do things. So, you know, there's that aspect of it. There's, you know, the trade schools that are out there. There's so many different ways you can make a living in this world that isn't a liberal arts degree. I was just talking to all of our customers that are here on campus, and we were talking about the labor shortage in construction. And, high school guidance counselors do not get credit for sending kids to trade schools. So they get, and by the way, there's this perverse kind of incentive program, which is, you know, I think they get more points on their card if they send somebody to Stanford than if they send somebody to Santa Barbara City College, and they get 0 points for sending them to trade school. So there's this inverse incentive program that keeps people out of trades, which is a huge crime. And so that's an area where I really want to focus. And then it's the stigma of entering a job that doesn't have the kind of the shine and polish of a, you know, doctor, lawyer, accountant associated with it that we still have to overcome. So we live in a society that I think doesn't quite understand that a pipe fitter can make 6 figures a year being a pipe fitter, and a college degree program, a person that has an accounting degree might make $65,000 the first year with 4 years of debt behind them.
And maybe AI is going to come for in some way, who knows,
yeah.
Right?
And by the way, AI is not installing pipe anytime soon.
No, yes, we're a long way away from that. Back up to the Charlie Munger thing, I think he had a quote that like, I consider myself top 1% in taking into consideration incentives, and I still underestimate it every day or something. It's interesting, like how many societal ways we're shepherding people to this path that I had no idea on the guidance counselor placement point system that's like discouraging, trade schools and stuff.
Yeah. We do live in an interesting time. I was talking to one of our customers about that, which is for hundreds or thousands of years, society worked pretty much the same way. Like I was talking about how when I was a kid, I had to be home when the streetlights went out, right? If I wasn't home before the streetlights went out, I was going to catch almighty hell from my mom. And then you think, you know, that was 75 years of that probably. Prior to that, you had to be home before the sun came down. And then we lived through this era where now everybody's connected, right? And they're always going to be connected forever. So we are going through a massive transformation of how this society runs and operates that we get this vantage point of seeing that no other generation before us was ever going to see. And it's both a blessing and a curse.
Oh, it's crazy. I mean, there's if you think about like 1600 to 1750, if you drop someone from 1600 into 1750, the world would look mostly the same to them. If you take someone from 1870 and drop them into today, I mean, just to think about the amount of change we've had in our lifetime, and it feels like we're just it's exponential, right?
Yeah.
It's definitely compounding in a meaningful way.
Like if somehow I had gone to sleep in 1986 when I graduated high school and you woke me up today, I would be, by the way, we were talking about it. We all had Encyclopedia Britannica. That's where we got our information. And I was talking to my customers about this and that, you know, if you had to do a book report on animals, all the boys wanted to do it on lions and all the girls wanted to do it on horses, right? So essentially the next day when you turned in your book report, everybody gave the same book report essentially because you only had 5 paragraphs from the Encyclopedia Britannica to gather the data on your subject. And like what a world we live in today where...
It's fascinating every single day and the manifestations of it. I guess I'm curious the artificial intelligence point that you guys... You guys are witnessing. Are there specific workflows or processes or things that you're observing or you see the opportunity for AI with Procore's business?
I just got a great example of one from one of our customers who's a subcontractor. Subcontractors, the majority of their costs are people, right? You know, they're people fitting pipes or whatever. And so if you can if you can get the same job done with one less person, that drops into the bottom line and you're doing well. This one company has figured out how to basically get more done with less people using AI, essentially getting the right person to the right job on the right day with the right material and the right equipment. It's a really hard thing to do. And they're using patterns in their data to get people to do that. And they're saving so many man hours. It's shocking. It was actually, you know, I think her example was they're taking a job that would take 12 people yesterday, and now they're doing the same job with the same quality, same velocity with 6 people.
Have you guys started to input it into your product itself?
Most definitely. Yeah. So so the beauty of Procore, again, being a platform, mm-hmm. is we have this corpus of data, right? And construction, though everything is a prototype, the processes within construction are the same over and over again. So if you're building a 120-bed hospital in Miami-Dade County, we have in our database, we have, 3,000 of those around the US or globally that we can then look for pattern recognitions and try to help identify challenges before they happen or next best actions for people to mm-hmm. take in the field. We were just all talking as a group with our customers about what we're going to look back on today, and we're going to say, wow, this is the time where this industry changed dramatically. Mm. It's going to be much less of a lone wolf at the job site, kind of trying to assemble and figure stuff out, to a data-driven business.
Yeah, and I guess you guys benefit from being, back to the platform point, but you have the centricity of data to make those recommendations on, this is deviating from the standard pricing of that pipe, or here's, you're missing this part that checks a box from a compliance or safety standpoint or whatever. So
here, I'll give you a great example. Everyone knows about the supply chain challenges. Supply chain challenges really hit the construction industry hard during COVID. And most of that has worked its way out, but except for complex electronic equipment. And so if you're building a building that requires a lighting control system or something that has complex electronic equipment in it, certain manufacturers are taking about 24 months to deliver the equipment. Well, that's forever. That'll stop a job from moving forward. And that's critical. We know in our system which air handlers or which lighting control systems are actually getting delivered quickly and which ones are being delivered late. So if a contractor's putting together the plan in Procore for their next project, and they put in a lighting control unit that we know has a 24-month lead time, we can pop up and tell them, hey, you might not want to do that. You might want to look at these three other ones that are actually coming much faster. It's that level of detail that will, and by the way, that means that a project that would normally take 36 months can now take 22 months. Mm. And that's real money for everyone.
It's fascinating. How did an eighth grade job at a cabinet shop influence your founding journey?
So I was somewhat of a privileged kid in a privileged society down in La Jolla, California. I hadn't really seen much of the world. When I walked into that cabinet shop that day and they welcomed me, I was working with carpenters. And these were people that lived in a different part of town than I'd ever been to before. But they also had a different mentality than everybody else. These were like people that were craftspeople that took pride in what they were able to do. And they did things that were awe-inspiring to me with their hands. And so all of a sudden I was like, I found my people. It kind of sounds funny I say it that way, but I did. I'm like, I want to be like these people. And by the way, my dad was a banker, and I'd gone to like the big corporate boardrooms and, on the bring your kid to work stuff. I had no interest in any of that. I wanted to be a craftsperson. So that got me excited about it. And all I wanted to do was learn. And fortunately for me, Jesperson who ran the company, put me into the journeyman apprentice carpenters program at the local union hall when I was in high school, and gave me the opportunity to become an apprentice carpenter. Hmm. And that just kind of sealed my fate. Funny thing was too, in 19, like whenever they came out, like 83 or whatever, I got a TRS-80 computer and I loved BASIC. I loved programming. My dad was saying not that long ago to me, we were talking about like my childhood and stuff. Like if you looked at my passions, right, they collided into Procore. It's technology and construction. So
it's fascinating. And your mom also got you a book, How Things Work or something, yes. Which I assume was around the same time, pretty yes. formative period.
She actually, funny enough, she got it for me, but she kept it on her bedside table as I was growing up. And we would just spend lots of time going through it I'll never forget. So then I got to be fascinated with how things work. So I started dismantling stuff around the house. And I'll never forget, I dismantled my dad's corded drill. And I couldn't get it back together again. And so I kind of like put it in a drawer where he couldn't find it. And I was just waiting for him to come, and kind of rip me apart. And he finally was looking for it. I had to fess up to the fact that I did it too with a carburetor. One of my first girlfriends had a car that back in the day, he had a carburetor. And she's like, I have a problem with my carburetor. I'm like, I can fix it. I took it apart. And it was like probably, 140 pieces. When I put it back together, there was like 17 pieces left
yeah,
over.
Yeah, missing from the, yeah.
And
yeah.
I'm like, oh, I am so much trouble.
I assume ex-girlfriend after that.
She was not very happy yeah. with me.
The early days of like the original insight or the kernel for Procore was it actually rooted in your own home and sort of seeing how inefficient the process was? Like, what was that? You guys moved from San Francisco down here to Santa Barbara, and your wife said you can come with me or not, but I'm going there. So maybe take us through the actual kernel of insight.
Yeah, so she did. So I was at the time doing this HR consultancy. So I was on planes all the time. I was in Charlotte and I was in Dallas. I was never home.
Was it like PeopleSoft, like integrations?
Yeah, actually putting web front ends on PeopleSoft. So PeopleSoft at the time was client server. And I was in the interactive voice response business. Do you know what that is?
Yeah, yeah.
So I was putting telephony front ends on PeopleSoft. This is before the internet.
For people that don't know, very, very sexy stuff, but IVR. So PeopleSoft is an HR company that was started by Dave Duffield, the new Boosery, which they've now started Workday, right? Which is the cloud version of it. But IVR is like when you call a phone and it's basically like press one for this, two for this, and that kind of stuff.
And for all the old timers, you used to have to call your bank to get your bank balance and put in 900 numbers to get to it. That's IVR. And so it's really a technology interface to analog phones. And how I got into that is a whole nother story. But I was doing that with these kind of Fortune 100 companies. And traveling all over the world, putting these telephone front ends onto, so you can enroll in your benefits program at Bank of America or whatever, because that was the way you did it. They had call centers too at the time, because if you couldn't figure out your numbers, you had to hit zero and you go to a call center. Bank of America had a call center. I think they had like 300 people in it, only for Bank of America employees.
So if I'm an employee of Bank of America and I need to enroll, it's open enrollment,
I need to get my new purchase plan.
Now it's obviously all on the internet. But I'm calling in and saying, press one for this, press two for this. And that was how you did the triaging of what plan you wanted to pick.
And then I also became the voice. So I was like the voice of Applied Materials University.
Oh, wow.
Like, so I would program the call tree and I'd be like, you know, press one for, and then I'd hit save, and then I'd program the call. Anyway, it was very weird. And but at the same time, the industry evolved, and all of these companies started coming to me saying, "Hey," and I was working for somebody. "Hey, do you want to? There's this new thing called the internet. Can you put a web front end instead of a telephony front end on the front of this?" And I'm like, "Sure." So that's kind of how I made that transition into that part of my world. So, and I got good at writing software for the internet.
And so then you moved down here in 2000, 2001?
Yeah. So I eventually it was in 1999, actually.
Okay.
When I got the phone call, she's like, "We're moving to Santa Barbara." I was in Charlotte at the time. And I'm like, "No, we're not." And she said, "No, yes, your son and I are moving there."
Yeah. I don't know how we define we, but.
Yeah. We is really not you. She's like, "I don't see you ever anyways." And, you know, anyway, so we ended up coming down here, bought a house. She wanted to remodel it. And that's kind of where, so then I would fly in on Thursday nights. And the first thing I'd do is go to Kinko's, because I'm really passionate about scheduling. So I was doing all the scheduling on this job with Microsoft Project. And so I would go to Kinko's and print out a big Gantt chart. I'd go back to the job site trailer and I'd meet all the subs. I'm like, "Okay, last week you said you're going to do this. What did you do?" And whatever, you know, "And next week, what are you going to do?" And so I'd write on the thing and then I'd put it back into Microsoft Project. And then anyway, what I learned was, a lot of times when I showed up, a lot of things that they said that they were going to do that week didn't get done. Hmm. What I really found out was, by the way, right there is a surf spot called Rincon, which is one of the most famous surf spots in California. What I found was when there was a point break out there, nobody would go to work, right? And so I created a correlation between my schedule and the surf report. And anyway, so I'm like, wow, there's no certainty in the schedule, but these people all know what they need to do. So if I can web enable this, I will. So essentially I took that's a funny story too, but essentially I took the needs I had as a person building a house, watching my money fly out the door with no accountability and no telemetry into how it was going, to I'm going to corral this whole chaos and I'm going to put together a system that's going to actually allow me to manage my project. Hmm.
And there's probably a lot of dependencies of if this person needs to do this on that time and a bunch of derivative considerations. And so the logic building all that stuff out.
Yeah. And if the carpenter, you know, Jim and the drywall or whatever, Mark, are sharing information about it's a 6-foot break of Rincon, they're both not going to show up.
Yeah, that's funny. In your mind, what's the coolest construction project that Procore's worked on? Anything that stands out?
So many cool ones. It's such a privilege. By the way, last week I went to go see a data center that I'd never been in. Data centers are highly secure facilities. So it's like a government facility. So it's, I got somebody kind of essentially sneaked me into a data center that was under construction. But I will say, without a doubt, it's a project called ITER, I-T-E-R. It's in the south of France. It's a, I think, 35 nations have come together to build a nuclear fusion reactor. It is, first of all, it's in the middle of south of France, so it's vineyards as far as the eye can see. And then there's this machine that's the size of a city that they're building there. Just to be able to walk through and be on the inside of a nuclear fusion, I was like literally inside the fusion reactor itself. It's not done yet. You know, you're like, I can't believe I'm able to do that. And the scale is just remarkable.
You say a city. I mean, how big is it? Is it actually?
It's a whole complex of buildings that are the size of, in some cases, like multiple sports arenas put together.
Wow.
And you know, ceilings that are, you know, I don't know, 150 feet high. Like it's and bolts that are this big around. Like this stuff's big. But by the way, if you think about it, when they conquer this fusion, the world's going to change, right? The dependency on energy is going to hopefully go away. And I just look at it like, man, the things that we're building are going to change the world. And it's a privilege to be able to see, you know?
That's super cool. We talked about you mentoring founders and getting to meet early stage founders, but I heard you say that you have gotten good at figuring out who has the fire in the belly to like go the distance on that. I guess that's partially my job as well, but I'm curious, are there any things that you found either question wise or deterministic things you can figure out from that?
You know, it's funny. The best way I kind of test it is I challenge them on their beliefs around their product and their mission and their vision. And the ones that just take the punch and come right back and and basically are bought in are the ones that I believe are going to have the kind of the kinetic energy necessary to get through. It's funny. So there's a technology program at UCSB for people. It's like an entrepreneurial program. And so I've talked to them several times and they'll come down here. I'll often get the question, which is like, you know, I'll ask people like, what do you want to do? And when people that answer, I want to be an entrepreneur, I'm like, that's not a thing, right? Like you don't become an entrepreneur.
That's like a basket of like a category. There's like specific things underpinning that.
Right. And really what it is that you're going to do something that this is novel and unique more than somebody else. And you're going to deliver value that hasn't been discovered yet in a way that's going to make you differentiated in the marketplace. Then people say you're an entrepreneur. But so I always say to them, like, I'm like, you want to be careful because people that say they want to be an entrepreneur, they haven't found the thing. So you just want to be careful that you're not just doing this because you admire people who are successful entrepreneurs and you want to be Mark Cuban, right?
Like, yeah.
You can't be Mark Cuban, right? Like you can go do something and you can, but I'm very cautious of founders that are doing it for the wrong reasons.
Interesting. And so does that mean that there needs to be a unique insight and resonance with the problem that they're going after rather than just wanting to solve something and finding the opportunity within it?
Absolutely. Yeah. And better, and hopefully they actually really understand the problem space that they're getting into. And that means that they've either been exposed to it. It's something they're knowledgeable about. And it's also funny with these entrepreneurial programs, which is most of the products that they're building up there are related to student issues.
Oh,
like,
of course.
You know, yeah. Like, textbook aggregation or student housing or whatever. And I'm like, you realize students have very little money, right?
Yeah, exactly. But it's their only exposure.
Right,
it's their worldview is, it's one
They didn't have the privilege of being in the eighth grade and working in a cabinet
shop. That's right.
You know?
That's right. Yeah. It's a funny thing that it's hard to, without working to some extent, especially with B2B problems, consumer, you can have a unique insight just as a person in the world. But with B2B, you're not really entitled to an opinion about construction platforms unless you are somewhere in the industry or have some exposure to it. Right. So it's interesting.
Well, the beauty of our industry too is a lot of people, the construction industry is huge. A lot of people grow up, you know, their families, and I mean, everyone seems to be in construction or knows somebody in construction. So, but it's even more, out there. Like, I don't think a college grad is going to write legal software, right?
Yes. You know?
But they might be able to, you know, compete with Procore because there's a lot of people that understand construction.
Yeah, that's interesting. We were just talking about, you know, random points of serendipity along the journey of people that intervened and sort of changed the course of your life as we wrapped. I'm curious. It sounds like someone comes to mind.
Yeah. Well, by the way, there's a handful because I think we all have them. But the one that really comes to mind is someone I wish I could find, and I don't think I'll ever be able to find this person again. But it's when I was a carpenter in the Bay Area before I was supposed to go back to USF. It was late in the afternoon on a Friday. I was working on building a deck for some high net worth person under the Sutro Tower in the Bay Area. And personal assistant to the owner of the house would come out every day and we'd have lunch together and just talk. And it was a Friday and it was the end of the day and I was putting my tools away and she walked out and she goes, you know, Tui, I think I want to say something to you. And I said, what? She goes, you seem like you're in the wrong job. You seem like you grew up in a good family. You seem pretty intelligent. You seem like you could be doing more than what you're doing or building a deck right now. And I went home that day, I quit my job. The next day, a guy named Skip Steveley, who was running a technology company in the Bay Area, literally knocked on my front door and offered me a technology job out of another story, which should have never happened, but I just happened to be home because I quit my job. And that would have not happened if this person hadn't given me that thought.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. And I wish, I don't remember her name and I, but yeah.
But changed the course of the, and yeah, I mean, the randomness and the serendipity of some of these interventions. We were saying like, the folks at Lead Edge, Nime Mehta, who was one of your investors, like sort of connected me with Battery, which otherwise I wouldn't have gotten hired in the venture. I had nothing that jumped out from my resume that said, oh yeah, this person is going to make it, which is, I'm indebted to them for having done it, as they remind me occasionally.
We all have these people and we all have to take a moment. I always say, like, sometimes I'm shaving in the morning and I have a moment where I'm just like, there's like four or five people that without their kind of belief in me, I don't know if I would be doing what I'm doing today.
Yeah.
You know,
it's cool. You've taken to building complex Lego structures as like a therapeutic exercise. Can you speak to why you enjoy this so much?
It's funny how uncomfortable of a subject this used to be for me. Because,
oh, really?
Because it's like, I had somebody make fun of me one time, like I'm a grown adult, and they were making fun of me like about it. And I was like, I can't believe that I'm reacting like a sixth grader on this
one. Yeah, the bullies
I'm a builder at heart.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, I'm doing this whole carpentry program right now to become a timber frame carpenter. So I'm always wanting to build something. It's not always practical to put your tool bags on and go out and build stuff. What I like about Lego are twofold. One is you get the satisfaction of building. By the way, same as a business, right? Every day I'm building Procore. Like I look at that. That's probably one of the reasons why I'm so engaged with Procore is I'm never done building it. But with a Lego set, like you start with something and when you're done an hour later, you've actually done something, even if it's a component of something bigger. And you get this sense of satisfaction of actually doing something, building something. So for me, it's that. The other is that, and my wife will attest to this, Procore consumes me, right? She always goes, God, I hope someday, if you're not at Procore, you figure out like, you figure something else out.
Yeah, because, another passion.
Yeah, because this is all you do. And so it really does help me shut off the kind of never-ending problem-solving Procore engine that's in my head and allows me to like not think about it. I also like to hike a lot. And I find that if I go off the trail and I rock hop up the riverbed, it's the same sensation. You can't stop and you can't mid hop stop and think about Procore. If you get your footing wrong, you're going to fall and kill yourself.
Yeah.
So like, I find like doing things like that are great distractions as well.
Interesting. Yeah. Have you ever looked at Lego's business?
Oh yeah. By the way, I just listened to a podcast, three-part. It is fascinating.
It's insane.
How they started off with like they were a toy company and they were failing and
yeah. It's a fascinating company and structure and all of that. Really,
I
impressive.
Really want to meet the current CEO. I'm very very interested in the way he thinks about the world.
How do you use Lego in the business?
So we have a we have a program where we educate students. We want to really get them excited about construction early on. We partner with Apple to do some stuff and we're very interested in solving the labor problem, and we think, what's the best way to do that? Let's get them young. So we have a Lego game that we have put together. In fact, and so the students use Procore to build a Lego building. And there's, you know, RFIs that have to happen. There's submittals and there's change orders that have to happen along the way. And actually the building that they're building is this building. It's an exact replica. So it's a full board game with an instruction manual and as well as an access to Procore.
How old are these students?
We do K through 12. We also, I've done it. all of us kids.
Yeah.
It's a really good way to get people to kind of understand what Procore does.
Can you custom commission things from Lego to build designs of your building?
You certainly can.
Oh, interesting.
There's a whole industry out there around this where, you can go and send a set of blueprints of your house and they'll make you a replica of it.
That's fascinating. And it's actually Lego proper. It's not like some offshoot derivative brand.
I don't believe in the offshoots.
Yeah, we have a purist at
heart. I'm a purist.
Here.
If it's not Lego, it's not Lego.
What's your favorite structure that you've actually built?
I just finished Notre Dame.
Oh, cool!
And it's like a 9,000 piece, and it weighs 40 some odd pounds.
And how long does that take?
Well, it's funny. People keep asking that, and I do it in fits and starts.
Yeah, got it.
So like, I'll do it at like an hour and a half after dinner or whatever.
Sort of episodic.
So yeah, it's, you know, if I added it all up, it's probably 30 hours.
Wow. And what do you do with them? Are they displayed around your house or you break them down?
No. Well, the two quick stories. My wife will not let them stay in the house. She refuses to. So we send
sounds
them
like she's a tough customer. She runs a tough ship in how
there's something to be said for having a strong wife.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. By the way, talk about humble. Like, she keeps me as humble.
That's good. That's what you need.
She is so unimpressed with me, Logan.
Oh, that's good.
It is absolutely remarkable. So we send these things to our regional offices. So like our Dublin office has the Titanic.
Oh, cool.
And the Paris office got Eiffel Tower and like, you know, so I do that. Plus I selfishly keep, I have a kind of a man cave up at my ranch. And so I keep the construction equipment ones I built. Like, I built a D11 bulldozer and I just built a construction crane. And you can control it with your iPhone, you know, the hook, the crawler and everything. It's really pretty cool.
That's fascinating. It's a you finished Notre Dame recently, but is that the favorite of?
Well, yes, the funny one on the favorite was I built the Millennium Falcon, which was probably 8,000 pieces.
Totally.
Also huge and big. And
I actually bought that. One of my partners is kids are really into it. And so as a thank you, he got me to come over to Red Point. And as a thank you, I bought the Millennium Falcon for his son to do. So
it was probably my favorite. It was really intricate. But the funny thing was I'd been working on it for a long time and it was on the dining room table and it was done. And my wife's like, okay, well, that thing's got to get out of here. And I'm like, okay, well, I can't really do it now. And she's like, well, we have people coming over. And so we had this piece of furniture in the dining room. It was really tall. She's like, well, why don't you put it up there? No one will see it, right? So we pushed a chair up against the piece of furniture and I went over to the table and I held it and I put it up above my head and I'm step up on the stair, on the 1 foot up on the chair, and the chair fell and I fell over backwards.
No way.
And, you know, 8,000 pieces exploded, right? And it was funny.
You're scurrying around picking it up before people come over.
Well, the first thing that happened was my wife started crying because she had seen me put like 40 hours of my life into this thing. And she's like, I just made him break this thing.
Oh.
But it was the moment where we both realized I don't care about that much about them after they're done.
Totally.
It's the project I care about. So like, swept it up, put it in a garbage bag, and gave it to my friend's kid and let him go off and do it again.
There's an interesting lesson there to bring it all the way back to the picking the board members you work with and the people on the journey, like the process. If you're not enjoying the process, the outcome isn't that satisfactory, right? There's not like some hill you climb and get to the other side and you're like, I've totally made it. You find new hills or things to compare yourself to along the way.
I had never thought of it this way, but you are 100% right, which is I am much more interested in the journey than the destination.
Yeah.
Though I like the destination has this nirvana state, but I also realistic it's never going to happen. But there are certain people that are only fixated on the nirvana state. But yeah, I take a passion that kind of enjoyment out of the chaos that's today.
The process of it all. It's interesting because I'm sure you've now found that you just recalibrate to new expectations. And so when you're talking to Satya Nadella or Toby from Shopify or whatever, now you have a new peer set. Once upon a time, your peer set was just the people in the construction industry trying to get by. And so if you're too fixated on the outcome, you're just going to recalibrate to new people. And so you'll always feel unsatisfactory of where you're going because Satya is running a bigger business or Toby or whatever it is, right? Yeah. It's just you have to enjoy the journey of it all because otherwise you recalibrate in some ways.
Yeah, no, it's I live in this very interesting world where I'm solving a problem that most people don't know or care about. But this is my world and I'm having a blast.
It's a fun one. Well, thank you for doing this. This was great.
Fun conversation, Logan, always. Yeah. So thank you.